guess we're ready to get started.
So a couple of housekeeping matters before we officially begin. Due to a bit of a scheduling glitch, I think that when this shiur was originally scheduled and the notice went out, I don't think there was an awareness, truthfully, that there was a Yom HaZikaron event that was being held in Skokie by the Yitzhak Mitzion Kollel. I think that the CRC was relying in part on the fact that there's some other B'nai Akiva program, I think, that takes place typically on the afternoon of Yom HaZikaron, which commemorates both Yom HaZikaron, and then it transitions and goes into Yom HaAtzma'ut. But of course, this is not in any way intended to compete, you know, Chas V'Shalom, against the Yom HaZikaron commemoration, which is extremely important, something that we believe very strongly in. So I'll note that this year as well should be viewed as dedicated to all of the Kedoshim who lost their lives fighting for Eretz Yisrael and as victims of terrorist attacks, which of course we commemorate on Yom HaZikaron. The second thing that I wanted to mention is that next week's shiur, I think Sam had asked me about it, because it didn't seem to be a strictly halachic topic. It was a little bit politically tinged as well in terms of the ramifications of the law of return and some of the current modifications that have been suggested with respect to the law of return. I thought that it would just be interesting from a halachic perspective to examine the interface between the political machinations in Eretz Yisrael and the halakhic process and the role of the Rabbanut and so forth, since I'm going off, Yemir Hashem, to Eretz Yisrael tomorrow, actually, to join in the Mizrahi conference, Shatoba Mislachas. I am very interested in hearing some of the briefings that are going to be presented at that point in time, regarding, number one, judicial reform proposals in Eretz Yisrael, and number two, some of the proposals that have been made with respect to modifying the law of return as well. And I figure that maybe, if I'm able to sit in on those sessions, I can bring back a little bit of additional wisdom, insight, and perspective from those sessions and share it with the Chabura. Of course, from a halakhic perspective, but, you know, intermingled with an understanding how the halakhic process interacts with the political process in Eretz Yisrael and how maybe, you know, it should interact and what our thoughts are about that. Finally, third, tonight's topic is from the Dayan's Desk number 115, which is intended to be, I believe, the 11th installment, if I'm not mistaken, of our analysis of the tshuvos of Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Sefer Tzadik Levracha, that are published in Hadarom, and I really made a commitment to myself, although it's very much B'li Neder, because how could it be otherwise, that I really want to finish it, because I think it's been a very, very nice run going through the tshuvos, but, you know, it's time probably to move on to other things as well. And I think we're close enough to the finish line that if I can leave this, if I can complete this introduction very soon, we might actually have a decent chance at making it to the end. But I've just found these, you know, absolutely riveting and fascinating. And for myself, it also just reminds me of so many of the interactions that I had with Rav Schwartz over the years, where I can sort of read into the tshuva and supplement what Rav Schwartz wrote based on things that he said to me, which you might call the Torah Shebaal Peh of the tshuvos and Rav Schwartz's own personal perspectives and his approach towards psaka in general, which has, at least with respect to myself, had a very profound influence upon me, because Rav Schwartz really was my major mentor in terms of entering into the world of Besdin, which occurred a little bit over 25 years ago. If you looked in my Sefer Kanfiyona, you'll see the first tshuva, chronologically, in the Sefer Kanfiyona was written in Aleph Adar Tav Shin Nun Ches, which I calculated, based on my superb mathematical skills and abilities, obviously, was a little over 25 years ago. And from the very beginning, from the very outset, Schwartz was there really guiding me at every single step along the way. So it just, I guess from a personal perspective, it has not only sentimental value, but also very concrete instructive value for me in terms of everything that I've learned from Rav Schwartz. So moving on to Siman Tes Zayin in Eben HaEzer. the Tshuvas of Eben Ezer. So here, Rav Schwartz speaks about a very interesting situation. A Shinoi Shema Abiget. This happens from time to time that somebody shows up and they're asked their father's name and so forth. And it turns out that they're giving the father's a name that was not really their biological father, but an adopted father's name. Now, we're very careful. One of the standard questions that's to ask whenever we do a chakira shemos, meaning an examination of a person's name to write in a get, one of the standard questions is, were both of your parents born Jewish? Both of your parents born Jewish, are you a biological child of your parents? Were you adopted or converted? So we try to find out if there was an adoption, if there was a conversion, those are some of the standard questions. But people don't always answer 100%, sometimes the truth only comes out afterwards, that a person may have lied, may have given their father's name. They don't like their real father, their biological father, who abandoned the family, let's say, when they were 1 year old or less, or whenever, and they really feel that their true father is their stepfather. Sometimes they don't even know who their biological father was. Maybe they were adopted and we know the person was Jewish, but we don't know their name. So then there is a practice that many Rabbanim have, who are Masadu Gittin, that you could write, assuming you know the person's Jewish and all that, you could write the father's name, but you just write Ben so-and-so Hamigadlo. That you write this is the person who raised them, not necessarily Menchus Yitzchak, says you could say Demiskeri, Ben so-and-so Hamigadlo, who's called the son of so-and-so who happened to raise him. But in this particular case, it happens that the name of the stepfather was written in the get, and the son actually knew there was his real biological father's name, but it said in the get the name of the stepfather. And Rav Schwartz writes at the end of the first paragraph, Shugam Ken Kohen, who also was a Kohen. Now, I think what Rav Schwartz meant by that was that the biological father was not a Kohen, and I'm sorry, that the stepfather was, yeah, the biological father was not a Kohen, and the stepfather was a Kohen. So not only did it have the name of the wrong father in the sense that it wasn't really his biological father, but it also had the wrong status in the sense that it wrote Kohen, when this fellow was not really a Kohen. But you could say the Kohen is going on the father, and the father really was somebody whom in people's minds and eyes was viewed as the genuine father. So why not just write a new get if we have questions about whether this get is valid because the biological father's name was not written? So the answer is that you know that there's, I think there was a famous movie called The Karate Kid. So this was the Karate Husband. So the husband, according to Rav Schwartz, you look in the second to third line, Hinei Habal Hanal Hu Ish Alam, he is a very strong individual, Hamisasek Bimulim Shel Karate, and he is a black belt or so, he's a karate master, and one of the reasons why they got divorced is because he was very, very scary, and the fear is that if we're going to ask him to provide another get, then this wife is going to be in danger of having her life snuffed out by the karate husband. So therefore, this is Mamash Sakonis Nefashos, says Rav Schwartz, so can we rely the evidence on the fact that the get says the name of the stepfather as opposed to the biological father? So the answer is that, and you find this in many, many of the Tshuvas, where Moshe writes about this and others, that you can really be mako because in a get, the main purpose of writing the person's father's name is to identify who the individual is. And if in people's minds, they identify the person as the son of the adoptive father because he really was the presumptive father over all of the years that this child was being raised, so b'dieved that is going to be the good enough. And in fact, the Ramah paskins this way in Shulchan Aruch and Kosher Mishpat with respect to shtaros. I don't have this in the source, but Siman Mem Beis Tessa Vav in Choshen Mishpat. The Rama says that if you wrote in a shtar that somebody was the son of their adoptive father, or they were the father of an adoptive son, Lo Mikmi Mizuyip, it's not considered to be a fraudulent or a false document. The Kosher Hoel Vigidlua Vigidlu, since this person did raise this individual, Roy Lechtov King. So therefore, it's perfectly appropriate to call the person by that name. This is Rabbi Kiva Egu, of course, the Knesset Segedola, who says that this is only if the adoptive father does not have other children. But the Nesivas HaMishpat on that siman in Choshen Mishpat says, no, that's not true. The only time it's a problem is if the adoptive father happens to have a biological son who has exactly the same name as the adopted son. Then you're going to have tzoros. However, other than that, it's basically okay to the Eben and the Igros Moshe, but Moshe Feinstein, which is the source that I printed in the materials, Kadadal Simon Chabab, says, Leka Kpedo Kokach, if in fact this was written in the get, that it was the instead of the biological father, the stepfather was written without writing Hamigadlo, so it really looks like it's the father, he says, no, we find a proof that this is perfectly legitimate from the Ramban, on in Sefer Bamidbar, where it says that Sarah was Basa Asher, that Sarah was the daughter of Asher. We don't know that Sarah was this famous figure who appears, you know, throughout Tanakh, or at least is alluded to, according to Midrashim, throughout Tanakh. And Sarah was Bas, or at least in Sefer Shmuel Beis, we know that Sarah was Bas, was not really the daughter of Asher, but really she was the daughter of the wife of Asher, and was a stepdaughter of Asher himself, Mikomakam Karakasu Bas Asher, unless she was called Bas Asher Vekahena Od Harvey. About Liftov, Tov Lahaske, Beferish, Beget, Bas Ploni, Shigidalto, Kibito, but when you are writing the Chatila, it's better to write, if you're going to write the stepfather's name, to write Hamigadlo, Shigidalto, Kibito, but he says, Makom Igun, you could be Mako, so Rav Schwartz felt this was definitely a Makom Igun because this fellow was the karate husband. So that was, and I've seen that come up sometimes. It doesn't come up so much because we really do a lot of very careful interrogation and questioning before we write down a person's shameless to really find out if the parents were the natural parents or if somebody was an adoptive parent. It's very important both in terms of confirming that the person is really Jewish and in terms of getting the name straight, but sometimes this has been known to happen. In addition,
would it be better maybe if just because it happens so frequently, simply modifying get the given to say chashila, just say, especially well, maybe perhaps when they're not religious, to say so and so who raised it.
That's what we do.
Generally.
Oh, general, even if it's the biological? No, because it doesn't happen that often. It doesn't happen that often. We ask all the time, but the number of adoption cases are not that frequent.
If the biological father wasn't Jewish, what would be the...
If the biological father was not Jewish, so then you have a bigger problem, because really it's generally presumed that you're writing the name of somebody who is genuinely a Jewish in the get. So
right.
That's, you know, something which, you know, really should be required, but... hard to say, you know, but the evidence, the person is known as this individual's son, and you wrote it down. Generally, that is something that would be more likely to be caught, I think, than the other way around.
So what is
I
the
think
right
so.
Thing to do?
Like, sometimes you have a person who is converted, or sometimes you have a person who is converted, and you write down the name of the adoptive parent, even then. If it's despite the fact that you left out the fact that the person was a ger, nonetheless, there's room to be mako because they are known as the child that person raised them.
I'm sorry, go ahead. You're right if he's the son of a Jewish mother and a non-Jewish father.
That's an excellent question. You know what the answer is? You write the Jewish mother. You write the Jewish mother. That's what you do. But in such a case, you leave out the father altogether and you just write the Jewish mother. Yes. Okay.
But then who gives the get?
Who gives the get?
Yeah,
well,
the
either the husband or the wife. The husband gives the get to the wife. What do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, but if you don't have a husband's name there...
No, we have the husband's name. It's just the husband doesn't have, let's say, a Jewish a father, only has a Jewish mother. So then you write the husband's name, Ben, the Jewish mother's name, as opposed to the father's name. Normally, you write the husband's name, Ben, the father's name, but in this case, you write Ben, the mother's name. And the same thing with the mother. Let's say that with the wife. Let's say the wife only has a Jewish a mother and not a Jewish father. You would write, let's say, Sarah Bas Miriam. And let's say it's Bas Miriam and Nicholas. You know, so you're not going to write Sarah Bas Nicholas. You write Sarah Bas Miriam. So we do that all the time. We do that all the time. Yeah.
But in doing that, in effect, isn't the wife giving herself the get?
No. It's still the husband who's giving the get to his wife. It's just a question of when we identify a person in a get, we identify the person in terms of their name and their father's name. But if they don't have a Jewish father, they only have a Jewish mother, so then we'll write the mother's name. Okay, but their name still appears. So their name still appears. So it's still the husband who's giving the get to the wife. Yes.
I think Rabbi Schwartz at this point pointed out that the problem was that the person, the adopted son, was giving the get to his former wife.
Correct.
And he would hurt her if things were made too complicated.
That's correct. That's why we didn't ask for another get. And in fact, in this particular case, the reason why there would have been a desire, I think more than in most cases, to have asked for an additional get is because you also had the additional wrinkle that the adopted father was a Kohen, and this person wasn't genuinely a Kohen. So that kind of made things a little bit more... I think that made it more b'dievet in this particular case. We felt the p'shas l'pkak, he says, m'chshash igon yesh ha'akshir es a get. Okay, he even wrote at the end that I could go on longer.
It would have been a bigger problem the other way around if the real father was a Kohen, because then he'd have been a Kohen and it wouldn't have been written in the get that he was a Kohen.
No. If you don't write in the get, a sin of omission is always better in a get than a sin of commission.
But in terms of getting remarried, there's no problem.
No, there's no problem. If a person's a Kohen and you left out that they're a Kohen, the get is 100% kosher.
But
if a person's not a Kohen and you do write that they're a Kohen,
but in terms of getting remarried... Yeah. You need to know that he was a Kohen.
That's okay, so you'll find out that the guy was really a Kohen. You left it out in the get. But that's always much better. That's a principle that the Ramah articulates in Evan Ezra Simon Kuf Kuf Ches. Always be, when in doubt, always better to do without. Okay, so the other snip, of course, in this case, that we should bear in mind was that the entire wedding was performed by a Reform cantor. And therefore, since it was done by a Reform cantor, chances are that you didn't have kosher witnesses, but, you know, he throws that in. But the truth is, that would have been room enough to be make or that maybe a get wasn't needed altogether in this case, or likely it wasn't. So now let's move on to Siman Yud Zayin. Binyan get the Zikun Miyadabal. This is a very hot button issue. There are people nowadays who want to say, oh, so if a husband is refusing to give his wife a get, no problem, we'll be Mizake a get, meaning that we will simply write a get on behalf of the husband, because it's a good thing for a man to give his wife a get when the divorce is over. Even if he doesn't want to do it, he doesn't know what's good for him. We'll decide what's good for him, just like you can be mezakeh a woman a get sometimes. Let's say that a woman is not available to receive a get, but she has a husband who converted to another religion. And now the husband is prepared to give her a get. So we say that this is a tremendous zechus for her to receive give it a better example. The woman herself is converted to a different religion. The first case, not as Pashim. The woman herself converted to a different religion, and therefore she's going to now live with non-Jewish men and not care about halakha at all, and she's going to violate Ashes Ish. She's going to commit adultery left, right, and center, and therefore in order to save her from sin, we'll have somebody receive the get on her behalf, even though she hasn't authorized this. So this is something that we say, la halakha, would be permissible. A woman is living with another man already, and she's not available to receive the get, and we're not sure she's going to agree to accept the get, so we say, let somebody receive the get on her behalf. That is to receive a benefit on behalf of somebody else. But this case is a little bit different, because the husband's not receiving a benefit, and he's not the one receiving the get, he's the one who's giving the get. Can you say that, oh, it's such an unquestionable zechus benefit for the husband to rid himself of this wife, so we're going to have somebody authorize the get on the husband's behalf, even though the husband has not authorized it. This was the Hoping Machlokis about 8 years ago or so with what the infamous get from Tzfat, a man who became like a vegetable. He went into a coma in Tzfat, and the question was that the wife was going to be an aguna for as long as he would just remain in this vegetative state, and it looked like it could be for many, many years. So some rabbis came to the conclusion that we're going to be mizake a get. We're going to decide that it's a benefit. The husband, if we would have asked him, he would have said, sure, write a get for my wife. Problem is, we can't ask him because he's in a vegetative state. So we'll do it on his behalf. And there was a major uproar, pretty much, you know, all the major rabbanim and poskim, you know, all over the world, saying this was a terrible psak. It's dead wrong. You're not allowed to do something like that. Because a husband absolutely is required to authorize the get. He has to be custom lot. Sefer Krisus v'nasam v'yadah. He's the one who has to either write it, or he has to authorize or instruct somebody else to write the get on his behalf, with the Shema, and otherwise it doesn't get off the ground, which is how we generally assume. So in this particular case, certainly, when the husband is screaming and yelling that he doesn't want to give the get, it's not even, you know, a question. So this was a question that Rav Schwartz was asked. This is Siman Yud Zayin. He said a letter to Rabbi Jachter Shlita. He says that apparently a get was written on behalf of a husband without the husband knowing about it at all. Is she permitted to marry on the basis of this get? And he points out that the Sridi Eish, Rav Weinberg, has a lengthy tshuva about this. regarding women whose husbands had converted to another religion, whether we just write a get on their behalf. And he comes to the conclusion, like any of those, there were some authorities that wanted to entertain this notion. It says that we see that the Rishonim did not hold this way. Even though you can make clever arguments to this effect, he says that we cannot authorize it. There was a professor in Israel by the name of Professor Antelman. Professor Antelman came up with this idea that maybe we'll solve aguna problems by just authorizing it and on behalf of the husbands. You know, forget about the cost of law, sefer krisos. We'll do it without the husband. And he called it liftos mechake get. Right? Everybody's familiar with liftos mechake ketz yeshua. So he calls this liftos mechake get. We're going to redeem all those women who are waiting for a get. Sometimes you'll see a get that's written by a conservative rabbi. And then the question is, you have to, was the get written properly? Were the names written properly? I find that they, almost in every single case, even the names are not written properly, just in my experience. If the witnesses who witnessed the delivery of the get are not kosher witnesses, they're not Shomer Shabbos, so then the get is invalid for that reason as well. All kinds of reasons why the get would be invalid. Rabbi Schwartz generally assumed, as a matter of course, that any non-Orthodox get is intrinsically invalid for all kinds of different reasons. But yet another reason why you have to be suspect of any conservative get is because a number of years ago they decided that they're going to utilize this technique. And if you see a get where it says, oh, the husband gave the wife a get on such and such day, often the husband did absolutely nothing. And they decided on their own that they're going to authorize the get on the husband's behalf to give to the wife, so you can't even believe the words because of the fact that they do in fact utilize this mechanism. So Schwartz says this is completely batul mevoto, and he says this is the third to last line. If this woman gets married with such a get, this is not one of these shas igun bidi yeva that maybe it could be kosher. He says 100%. This get is no good. And so Rav Schwartz was somebody who was very, very sensitive, would look for leniencies wherever he could find it, but if no leniency was present, so Rav Schwartz would put his foot down on behalf of the integrity of the halacha and the Mesorah. He felt very, very strong about this. The famous statement, which is attributed to the Ksos HaKoshin, if you look on source Aleph in Simon Yudayan, with respect to Afasha Schala, where the Chumash Hadeshin had come up with an idea that a person's servant, meaning Jewish servant, would be able to take challah on their behalf if, let's say, the woman of the house is not home and so forth. The Ksos HaKoshin says that doesn't work. Because you need shlichus. So you need, in order to take truma or challah for somebody else, they have to appoint you for this purpose. If they haven't appointed that individual, that person can't take it. Because he says, this, look at the third to last line towards the second half. Lo amin in zakan liyadam shlobabana. You can't say zakan liyadam. You're going to accept something as a benefit, like a gift on behalf of somebody. Unless the person who's going to get it is going to actually receive something. Like I pick up a diamond ring on behalf of somebody whom I know would want to have that diamond ring. Over mizakeh gelishto, or somebody receives a get on behalf of a wife who definitely would receive a benefit by having the get because she's married to somebody, because she's living with somebody else. Mizokeh should be get. Makish mishebel abayas, but if you're going to take away something from somebody, like you're taking challah from their dough without their permission, ain says zuchus. So that's not a zuchus. That is a totally different principle that requires a shlichus. A zuchus means that I'm receiving something on behalf of somebody else that's an unmitigated benefit. Here's just a question, would they want me to do it? If it's a question, would they want me to do it, then you need actual shlichus. Then you need an actual appointment of an agent. And if you don't have an appointment of an agent, we say zaken le'adam shlobefanam, but we don't say zaken me'adam shlobefanam. Not only that, but so Shechter points out, or Shechter Shlita, when it comes to gittin, we also require a higher level of das than we require with respect to other things. Like, for example, when people get married, so what do they do before they get married? They sign a tanoim. Tanoim, right? The tanoim document says that I agree I'm going to get married. And then we don't say, when they're underneath the chuppah and the husband's about to give his wife a ring, we don't say, did you promise somewhere that you're going to give your wife a ring, that you're going to marry her? And if you did promise, so then we're going to nullify any such statement. So what do we nullify any such statement? So that's good, you promised, and now you're going to fulfill your promise, and mazal to mazal to. But when it comes to a get, if the husband made a promise, we say, did you make any promise or commitment or oath, you know, or vow that you're going to give your wife a get? So we're going to nullify any such statements. Why do you have to nullify any tanayim, any kind of promise that the husband may have made? Because there's a higher level of das. Because the sefer krisos v'nasan b'yad, Yada requires a higher level of das, even then with respect to a Kiddushin, there can't be any kind of extraneous considerations or influences with respect to the giving of the get. It has to be something which the husband is very consciously and voluntarily and mindfully deciding that he's going to give it to his wife. So you certainly can't just have somebody else do it on behalf of the husband without the husband's authorization at all. Okay.
There are cases where you can things can be done for somebody without getting anything. I can sell the chumetz, I can make an Erev Tavshilin, right?
That's the question. So with respect to the selling of the chumetz, so you can argue that that also, according to the Tzos, maybe that's a problem because I'm not giving to them, I'm taking away from them. So that's where you come to Rosh Hector's explanation that selling the chumetz doesn't require that higher level of das, as well as other explanations.
In theory, he's getting money for the sale.
Right. You could also say he's getting something because he's getting money for the sale. Right. As I said, there are other explanations as well.
He's also getting the benefit that his chumetz won't be ushered.
Well, it's always a benefit.
Right. But as you pointed out, he is in fact actually getting something because he's getting some money for the sale. You could say he's getting, you know, he's not just giving away, but he's also getting money for the sale.
Question that David brought up that the husband didn't want to give a get, or that you talked about whether I didn't give a get on behalf of the husband.
Right.
But the bottom line is that there is no situation that a Beis Din like yours, you condone such a thing.
Absolutely not. And that's this tshuva of Schwartz, where Schwartz pointed out that there's no wiggle room with respect to this particular halakha, and that's how it's generally assumed.
Even, like you said, if someone disappears for years?
Even if he disappears for years. Unless, you know, he had authorized the get beforehand. What we do is, for example, let's say a man's going out to war, and we're afraid he's going to be taken captive, and we're not going to know what happened to him. Maybe he's dead, maybe he's alive somewhere, but we don't know. So what would be done in these wartime cases, called get nochama, is that husbands would sign an authorization form that if they're missing for 18 months or so, so then they authorize that a get should be written to their wife, and they authorize the scribe who's going to write the get, they authorize the agent who's going to deliver the get, they authorize the witnesses who are going to sign on the get. All of that is written down in the document ahead of time. And that way, if 18 months pass, either he's dead, in which case his wife can remarry, but even if he's not dead, then you can act upon the authorization form. When we had the Persian Gulf War, for example, people came into the Beis Din in America, people were chaplains, people going out into the army, and they signed these authorization forms. They used to do this as a matter of course in Eretz Yisrael, until at some point in time, I think it was decided by the Rabbanut, that they wouldn't have people going into the army into war sign these forms because they felt that it was bad for army morale. And the Tzitz Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg said, that's nice that they say it, but come to me and I'll do it for you. Because he still thought it was a good idea. They used to do this, you know, in the days of Milchemes David. That was the explanation given as to why it wasn't a problem, you know, strictly speaking, for David to be with Bathsheba, because there was a get Muhammad that was authorized by Uri Yafitik.
Did they put an alternate scribe in? I mean, what if over the 18 months the scribe dies or the witnesses?
No. So you can't put an alternate. You can say anybody, I'm appointing this scribe, or anybody who sees this document can see my scribe, because that's considered to be exclusive enough. You're not saying the entire world, which wouldn't be exclusive enough, but you say anybody who sees this document, so that's considered to be enough of an appointment. Okay, let's move on to Simen Yudches. Simen Yudches, Ishem Aguna Misrevis Get. This is your standard case. A woman is being deprived of a get. Her husband's refusing to give her a get. So here, Rav Schwartz relies on the approach of Moshe Feinstein, that the woman it happens was, in this case, similar to two shuvahs ago, she was married by a Reform rabbi, actually a Reform leader, in Oakland, California, it turns out. And therefore, there were two problems with the wedding. One is that there were no witnesses who were kosher, nor was Shomer Shabbos. Number two, the entire the food that was served was at the wedding reception was all trade food. So therefore, since all the guests presumptively ate all of the food that was served at the wedding reception, so we can assume that's another reason why they wouldn't be kosher leidus, because they didn't eat kosher. Then afterwards, the couple did not live in a place where there were Jews who were shomei Torah mitzvahs. Now, why is that significant? It's significant because there was the following ongoing machlokas between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Henkin, Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. That everybody agrees that if you had a wedding ceremony in which there were no kosher witnesses, so that wouldn't be a kosher wedding. It'd be a husband gives his wife a ring and there were no kosher witnesses, or two non-Jews standing there, two non-Shomer Shabbos, so that shouldn't be a kosher wedding. But what happens afterwards when they're living in a community And there are people who are, let's say, Shomei Shabbos, who know that this couple is holding themselves out as husband and wife. So Repenkin held that when people see that they go into their home together, they're holding themselves out as husband and wife. So when the husband has relations with his wife, and the most to be lost nus, a man does not make his intimate relations promiscuous in nature, so he has in mind that it will count for Kiddushin purposes. And Ramosha Feinstein consistently quoted a tshuva of the Rivash, that we've discussed before, and that's but also reprinted in these materials, the page 3.
He thinks they're already married.
Exactly. So Repenkin said it's not true. But Repenkin said, come on, if they were only engaged in just sort of a civil marriage, so obviously that wasn't a Jewish marriage, so now he's going to have relations with her, so it's going to be for the purposes of having a Jewish marriage together, and that's his intention when he has relations with her. So Rav Moshe Feinstein pointed out, that's not what the Rivash says. The Rivash in Simon Bava, the Shadows of Chuvas of the Rivash, of course we're talking about a Rishon here, one of the later Rishonim. So the Rivash has said that when you had people who went, or they were Anut, they were forced out of practicing Judaism through these, you know, they were Anusim and Anusot, but they made a conscious choice that they're going to live basically in accordance with the mores of the non-Jewish society, and they get married by non-Jewish priests who have a non-Jewish ceremony in which there's no ring that's given over by the husband to the wife. They just say, we now pronounce you man and wife, and maybe they give them the rings. The Rivash says that you can't say about such people who have where they're clearly not observing anything, you can't say that they have in mind afterwards that when they're living together, that they're living together for purposes of finalizing a Jewish marriage. And therefore, in a case that he dealt with, where the husband then disappeared afterwards and the wife wanted to come back to the Jewish community and she didn't have a get, even though the husband was Jewish, he said that since the marriage was not a marriage, she doesn't require a get. So Moshe Feinstein said, when people get married in a civil marriage ceremony and they're not going to keep laws of Nida afterwards, for example, so it's clear that they're not interested in having a Jewish marriage altogether. So when they live with each other, the husband does not have the intention, oh, I'm now living for the purposes of a Kiddushin, so it doesn't matter if there are Jewish people who live in the area or not. But Moshe Feinstein tried very hard that whenever he was going to be matir a case where a couple was only married in a civil marriage, or let's say they were married in a reform marriage, he tried to explain that his heter of allowing a woman to remarry without a get, if the husband would refuse to give a get, was also something that would work in many, many cases, even according to the reason of Rav Henkin. So if you take a look at the second, so you take a look over here in Rav Schwartz's tshuva. So Rav Schwartz says that, okay, so what was the problem with a reform marriage? Number one, you didn't have kosher witnesses. Number two, the way in which they perform the wedding probably is not kosher anyway. He knows that the ring belongs to the husband. It's a double ring ceremony. They don't know who's marrying whom. Maybe nobody's giving a ring and so forth. But then he goes on to say also, that he quotes from Rav Moshe Feinstein, who says that the marriage is absolutely null and void. So if you look at, I have an assortment of the Shuas of Rav Moshe Feinstein going over from page 1 to page 3. So Rav Moshe Feinstein points out that very often you have other considerations. So take a look at the top of page 2. So he says that even Rav Henkin would agree when it's not a civil marriage, but it's, let's say, a reform marriage. Reform marriage with no kosher witnesses. So here he says, Lo shayach ha-chazaka, it's about 7 lines down page 2. Lo shayach ha-chazaka, dein bo bilas nus, the rei das kiddushin rishonim bo. Who was it who said this? That he's relying upon the first marriage. You said that, right? He's relying upon the first wedding ceremony, because he thinks that a reform rabbi, they think a reform rabbi is a perfectly legitimate Jewish wedding officiant. So therefore, they're relying upon that first wedding ceremony, and they don't have in mind to consummate a Jewish marriage afterwards. So therefore, he says that even Rav Henkin would agree in that particular case. Rav Henkin was still alive, so you could say Rav Henkin, if he wanted to disagree with Rav Moshe's assessment of him, he could have, you know, done a machad. He said, no, Rav Moshe, I disagree with you. So he wrote, you know, this says Rav Henkin Shlita. Number two, he says that Rav Henkin was relying upon the fact that they might be living in a neighborhood where there are Jewish witnesses who will see them walking into the home and they're living together. But he said that this couple, in his particular case, Yotem Matzoi, if they're not Shomei Torah Mitzvos, then it's more Kamish Lotar Arashim Kelu Shadim Torah Shomei Torah, but Malkam Shematzoi Shomei Torah. They're probably not living around another Shomei Torah. They're living, you know, in some hick town in Mississippi or something, but there are no other Shomer Shabbos anywhere, and therefore, for this reason as well, according to Rav Penkin, it wouldn't count for anything. And then in the next tshuva, this tshuva that he wrote, the first one was in 1969. Rav Penkin was nifter in 1973. So it was written 4 years before Rav Penkin died. The next tshuva was written in 1974, which is 1 year after Rav Penkin died. So Rav Penkin already became a zatzal. But in this tshuva, he said the same thing. He said that in this case, a woman was a grusha. She comes to America and she works out her own shidduch because she figures she has to get remarried. And there's somebody she really, really loves, her cousin Vinny. Her cousin Vinny happens to be a Kohen. And she's a grusha. But they work out to get married with each other. And of course, they get married in some sort of a reform wedding. So Rav Moshe here says as well that in this case, because it was a kind of a reform wedding, even Rav Penkin would agree that they are original, that there's a reliance, shall we say, upon the original marriage, and therefore there's no presumption that the subsequent intercourses between them are being done for the purpose of getting married, because they think they're already married. And number two, that they probably live in a location where you don't have many people who are Shomer Shabbos, so you don't have to aid them Sharim. But he says that this is only the Rav Chaim Milson. This is very important. He says, let's say, because we do this, when we have cases where a husband refuses to give his wife a get, and they will only marry in reform marriage, so we'll do our research to see whether any kosher witnesses at the wedding and so forth, and then we'll ask lots of questions. Where did you live afterwards? Did you live somewhere where there were kosher edim? Because maybe if they live somewhere where there were kosher edim, we'd have to be worried that there's a possibility that kosher edim saw them go into their household as husband and wife. Well, Moshe Feinstein points out that's a nice additional consideration, but you don't need it. According to him, you don't need it, because he fundamentally holds like the Rivash, that even if there were people who were Shomer Shabbos living on their block, the assumption is that they didn't care enough to have an Orthodox wedding to begin with. They don't really care enough to say, oh, let's make sure that we're going to get married now by sanctifying the intercourse that we're having on our block with lots of Shomer Shabbos. If they become Baal Teshuva after they get married, it's a much more difficult shaila. Much more difficult shaila. And my Rebbe, Rav Mordechai Willich Shlita, thinks that if, let's say, they're living in a frum community, they originally were reformed, got married reformed, and now they're living in a frum community for like 40 years, and now they get divorced and the husband disappears. And the wife says, oh, we've got a reform marriage and maybe I don't need a get. So Rabbi Willich says, well, in this case, you don't have that argument so much. In this case, it's much more difficult to be mekel because of the fact that they really did have that sensibility, that they understood that the first wedding was no good and they probably were living together as husband and wife in their frum community for the purpose of actually having a kosher marriage to each other, and therefore they may have had that intention. Therefore, it's much more difficult to be mekel in those cases. Not that you couldn't stretch it according to Rav Moshe be mekel anyway, but much more difficult to be mekel in those cases. And he says here is a third consideration that he says would perhaps also work even according to Rav Penkin, which is that here they are not really so careful. We see about keeping any of the laws, keeping the kohen by the kedushin over yisuchamor, because here's a grusha being married to a kohen, and they know every single time that they're living with each other that they're violating an issur lav d'oraisa. Right? That Isha Grusha B'Shalo Yikaka, that a husband, that a Kohen is not allowed to marry a woman who is a Grusha, who is a divorcee. And therefore, for sure, you can't work with the presumption that they're so going to be so meticulous that they want to have a Jewish marriage and not live in the sin out of wedlock when they're not concerned about living in sin as a divorced woman married to a Kohen. According to the Rambam, it's probably a lesser sin if they're not actually married. So that would work in militate almost in the opposite direction.
Am I misunderstanding the title to this siman? Isha Aguna Misurevet get, does Misurevet mean she refuses?
No, that would be Misarevet. Misarevet if she refuses. Misurevet is in the passive. That means that she is being refused a get. Misurevet, yes. Okay.
Issue of kosher witnesses at a reform wedding, it seems like that would absolutely never happen. That reform people in a reform community would not have reason to seek out, let's say, Orthodox witnesses.
As a general rule, I think that's true. It's in the reform weddings, so that's where Moshe says that your Baruch Shekibanta, and the third tshuva, which is on the bottom of page 2, going on to page 3, and the tshuva from 1976, he says that I wasn't able to review, I wasn't able to research a particular case so much, But he found the copy of the ketubah. And the copy of the ketubah said that it was, showed that the wedding was performed by a reform rabbi. And he said that this was a reformer aduk. This was somebody who was an incorrigible reform rabbi, somebody who was very very attached to his movement, Beimala Bar Yosef. And he says, and therefore, there's no reason to do any further research. Because in such a case, you can absolutely assume that there were no kosher witnesses. In a conservative wedding, you have to do a lot more research because often you do have Shomei Shabbos people, some of Shomei Shabbos conservative rabbis, conservative balabatim. There's much more research you have to do. And he says, Uveklal, he says that if they went, what else you need to worry about? Maybe they got married to a reform rabbi and then afterwards they decided to do an upgrade. So he said that you don't need to worry about, because if they went to the reform rabbi in the first place, then you can assume lo yasu ol chupa v'kiddushin ein tzarav mamish. They're not going to go afterwards to a real rabbi. But chupa v'kiddushin. So chazaka, if they started with a reform rabbi, they're going to stay with the reform, because if that's how far they've strayed, that they are in the realm of the reform movement. So then the assumption is that they're going to not have a recognition that it's important to do an upgrade. And once you see that there was a wedding with a reform rabbi, you can assume that that is where they continue to hang out, unless you learn otherwise. And therefore, there's no reason to be more machmir in this particular situation when the husband is refusing to give a get. Now, if you go on to Simon Yates deals with another situation where Rav Moshe felt that Rav Henkin would be Mekel. And that is, in all of these cases, by the way, Rav Moshe did say that in the first instance, you should always be Makhmir for Rav Henkin because he was an eminent authority. So he tried to find ways to say that Rav Henkin himself would have been Mekel. But he said that as a general rule, you only are Mekel if the husband's refusing to give a get. But if if the husband would agree to give a get, then obviously that would be the right thing to do, to get the husband to give a get. So in Simon Yates, he had a case where there was a woman who got married in Russia, in Kiev, and now the husband went to Los Angeles and he's refusing to give her a get, and she's about to get married. It's a very interesting case. She's about to get married by a conservative rabbi. She's about to get married to another man, a Jewish man, to a conservative rabbi. So why in the world are they asking Rav Moshe the question? If they're going to a conservative rabbi, so why did they go to the conservative poskim to ask whether it's okay? So it's a very fascinating thing. This question was brought to him by Rabbi Shalom Rifkin, who is the chief rabbi we know of St. Louis. And Rabbi Rifkin said that this conservative rabbi, he always comes to me with his shadows. The conservative rabbi, he comes to me, that he says, go and ask Rabbi Rifkin his opinion is, and I'll follow what he says as to whether I can perform this wedding or not. So Rav Moshe quoted from Rav Henkin, and he said that even Rav Henkin would be making on this particular case, and we know that because we have the tshuva in page 3. If you look at the tshuva Simon Yates, Al Das Eruse Arkos Lev Ibra. Lev Ibra, of course, was a sefer written by Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin said that for the communists in Russia, we mentioned this once before, that when they get married, it's not a real marriage from the perspective of how we define marriage. That basically in communist Russia, ein makpidim al hefkin shoseh. Not makpid if the women do spouse swapping or wife swapping, and they cheat on each other and are completely unfaithful. That's just the nature of communist society. So it's not a real marriage. And not only that, he says the communists, since they don't believe in any kind of religion, they're makpid that there shouldn't be any kind of a marriage that would work from a religious perspective, and therefore he felt that since in the government is so makpid that there shouldn't be any quote-unquote Jewish marriage, and therefore he felt that this case, even Rav Henkin, would agree, would fall within the contours of the chew of the Rivash, where it was a time of anusim, where you were not allowed to practice your Judaism. Somebody went outside of the Judaism to get married, so the Rivash wasn't worried that they're going to consummate the marriage according to Jewish principles. So even Rav Henkin agreed in this particular case as well. Rav Moshe threw in a tshuva that he wrote in Chelek Dal Siman Peyal from Eben Ezer, as another consideration for marriages in communist Russia, that there isn't really a gemuras das, he said, when they get married. So everyone knows that at any point in time, the Russian government can just pluck up one of the spouses and send them off to Siberia. So what kind of a long-term commitment are you going to marry anybody when you know that your spouse can just be sent to Siberia at the drop of a hat at any moment in time? So therefore, Rav Moshe said in this particular case, even Rav Henkin would be Mekel, since even Rav Henkin would be Mekel, and therefore the woman's permitted to marry without a get when the husband is refusing to give her a get. But what's interesting is, he was prepared to be Mekel, despite the fact this woman didn't look that she was on a path towards Frumkeit. But Moshe Feinstein wrote in one of his early tshuvas in 1961, when he was dealing with a woman who got married through a civil marriage, and he said that there were all kinds of considerations to be Mekel, but if the woman's not going to keep Pilchas Nida, Ein Manu is Dakad Lush, and Imtzak, the Messiah Nanu Labolis to Nida. Why should we help her? Why should we say her husband's refusing to give a gift, we're going to let her marry somebody when the marriage is going to be premised upon a knowledge that they're going to violate Isuri Torah? He left it as a tzarki in Ladina. He says, only kishitikabel alef, lishma hilchas nida, yeshli's dakik love. She says she's going to now, from now on, be from, so then we can help such a person. That, I'm told, is still the policy in the Rabbinical Council of California, that when they are dealt with questions of this sort, whether there was a marriage that was valid, and then whether they can give a heter because the woman kasher ate them, the first question is, well, is the woman who's asking for the heter, is she prepared to be firm in the future before we allow her to get married to somebody else? Because if we're going to help somebody and give a heter, it should be based on the fact that they're going to be scrupulous in terms of Torah mitzvahs in the future. Why else should we do mental somersaults to help the individual? I did not find this insistence in many of the later shuvas of Moshe. Every now and then it was mentioned again, but by and large I didn't find it consistently in the later shuvas of Moshe. I never found it through Rav Schwartz. Rav Schwartz's general feeling was that if he's engaged with an individual who comes to him, so this is part of his kiruv. This is part of his kiruv to kind of build up their love and appreciation for Torah mitzvahs, if they have a positive experience through interacting with Rabbi Schwartz, and if you can give them a heter al pi halacha, so that was a way to steer them in the right direction, even over here. So the person's getting married to a conservative rabbi. This is a conservative rabbi who consults with Orthodox rabbis. That was very meaningful, as I've mentioned in the past. That was very meaningful to Rav Moshe. If there's somebody who's consulting with Orthodox rabbis, that's already something that's heading or steering in the right direction, and Rav Schwartz would be much more open to helping people in that type of predicament. Well, that's what we do in the CSC. When we are helping people in these cases, we emphasize the importance and the beauty of Torah mitzvahs and very strongly encourage them, and now you go up and you're going to try to keep Shabbos better and so forth, and they generally will make that type of a commitment, but that's part of the process. Simon Chav is interesting because Simon Chav is a tshuva that was not written by Rav Schwartz, but it was co-signed by Rav Schwartz. It was written in 1973. In 1973, the Abbezdin of the Bezdin of America was Ramosha Levi Halevi Steinberg, the brother of. Ramosha Levi Steinberg was the one who wrote this tshuva, and what's interesting about this tshuva, it's also, it turns out that it was a woman who was married by a Reform rabbi, although you don't find that out until about three paragraphs into the tshuva, but he consulted. He writes in the tshuva, I consulted with Ramosha, Ramosha said to do this. Then we couldn't do that, so I consulted with Ramosha again. Ramosha said, well, if you can't do A, so do B. And this is how the heter was arrived at. This was a case as well where the woman had a Reform marriage, but they really tried to do a proper get. They received a get from another rabbi who presided over the get, but it turned out that the get was written with the wrong names. The names weren't written properly, so the Bezdin of America at the time sent back the get to whichever rabbi was presiding over the get, and they said, write us another get. But then, in the meantime, the husband was sent to jail for some crime that he committed, and then they weren't able to get through to him, and then when finally he was released from jail, he ran away and was never heard from again, and they can't find him. And now 2 years have passed since the time that they wrote the get. There's a typo here. I apologize, but now, you know, those who are in the shiur will find out about the typo, which is that this shuva was transcribed from a handwritten shuva. And when it was transcribed from the handwritten shuva, so in the second to last line of the first paragraph, Abu Yosef Mishnasayim Mizman should be Ksiva Seget. From the time that the get was written, not the time the Sina Seget. I went back and I looked at the original handwritten tshuva, and it really is Ksivas, but it wasn't, it was written kind of in very cursively in a way that was difficult to read. When it was transcribed mistakenly as Nesinas, but really be Ksivas Seget. So 2 years had passed from the time that the get was written, and the poor woman, what are we going to do? So he said, I spoke to Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Moshe Feinstein gave us a great idea, that the Sofer and the Eidim, based on the, since it was a Shlichut, it was an agency, a get written by agency by the husband, so the people who had been originally appointed by the husband to write the first get, so you say, the husband typically says, you can write one get up to 100 gittin, until a valid getting comes into my wife's hands. So this was only one get. She said, have them write a second get. But because of the fact that the first get, you know, was already written, so have them have the shliach, the agent, deliver both the first get and the second get. But it turns out that when the Bezdin of America returned the get to the original officiant of the get, it was ripped up. And Rav Steinberg is besides himself in anger. How could it possibly, how do you rip up a get? Did I tell you to rip up the get? He had ripped up the get. So he was just, he says. He quotes a lot from, like, he has lots of biblical allusions. So he says, Yehei Etshi, and then it turns out that the Sof and the Edom are no longer alive. So he says, Yehei Etshi, Yehei Asof and Edom Megam Get, Amenu, Be'isha Aguna. Making a reference, of course, to Reuven's statement when he returned to the boar. He has all kinds of things. Then he says, Kama Lelos Nadarati Shena, which of course is a reference to Yaakov said, Batidach Nasime Nai. It was a very, very, you know, yes, very lyrical, Ramosha Steinberg. And he goes on in this vein with the Jew. He says, and I tried so hard to come up with a solution. And finally I realized, you know what? When I looked at the facts of the case, I realized that the woman told us that the wedding was performed in the office of a Reform rabbi in his Reform temple, and according to her and her relatives, everybody there was not observant. How do we know that we can trust her? Well, once we have proof, presumably they had documentation that the officiating rabbi was a Reform rabbi. So he quotes from another Chua of Rav Moshe that there's rumor to be lenient, to trust the word of even relatives to say that there were no kosher witnesses, because the presumption is, as you mentioned, that in a Reform wedding you're not going to have kosher witnesses as a matter of course. Nobody there was declared by a Beis Din to be postulated. He says you don't need. When people are mixed up the Russia, they're not keeping Shabbos, they're not keep getting mitzvahs, they're identifying with the Reform movement, which doesn't believe in basic tenets of Judaism, so then you don't need a Kabbalah Seidus. He quotes from a Knesset Gedola, and therefore there's room to be makel to assume that there were no kosher witnesses there altogether. And he said that he consulted here as well with Rav Moshe, because he said that even if they live together afterwards, this goes back to the theme that we've been discussing up until now, they would have relied upon, this is the second last paragraph, they would have relied upon the Reform rabbi, and therefore we don't say Ein Adam Oseh Bilas O Bilas Nutz with respect to this particular case. And then he quotes again from another conversation. This is the beauty of this tshuva. Rav Moshe Feinstein was still alive, and the brother of had a good relationship with Rav Moshe. So he says, Hagon Rav Moshe Shlita Amar Li She'ak Shehagon Rav Henkin Shlita Humei Machmirim. It was still Rav Henkin Shlita, because this tshuva was written in Chof Tes Iyar Tavshin Lamed Gimel, and it was only on Yud Gimel Menachem Av, a couple of months later, or 3 months later, I guess, or 2.5 months later, when Rav Henkin was nifter. So this tshuva was written 2.5 months before Rav Henkin was nifter. And he said that Rav Moshe said that even though Rav Henkin was machmir when it comes to civil marriages to require a get, Rav Nidon Gezesh Lefanenu, Gamu Maskim Shenet Tzrika Genem Utes Le'amak, he would also agree, since it was a Reform wedding, that there's no get that's required because they relied upon the original Kiddushin. And therefore, he said that we can be Mako, and this was signed by Rav Steinberg, and by Rav Dayado Schwartz, and by Rav Schwartz's good friend as well, Rav Shalom Rifkin, who is the chief rabbi of St. Louis. So it's just a very interesting historical artifact, this particular tshuva, just an early tshuva that was signed on by Rav Schwartz. But you can see Rav Schwartz would often quote the brother up. He learned a lot, and a lot of his Derech HaPsach came from the brother of, and if the brother of said something, or Schwartz would say, like in a very reverential tone, the brother of said that was the end of the story. The brother of said that was the end of the discussion. Yes.
Just the wording over here, whatever they have, Shlita, right afterwards it says Zatzal.
We did that. So at the time the tshuva was written was Shlita, but then afterwards it became Zatzal. Right. And so that's standard, you know, practice for these types of, you know, Torah journals. Moving on to Chosha Mishpah, we have 7 minutes, 3 tshuvas, no problem. So Hasavas Bul, Rav Schwartz, wrote this letter to Rav Binyamin Shandalov. Rav Binyamin Shandalov brought this question to Rav Schwartz regarding a makolet that was opening up, you know, a grocery store that was opening up, and they were selling baked goods. But there was a baked good store and a bakery in the area in Chicago that said, how dare you do such a thing? You're going to ruin my business. So they said, you know, and we want to have exclusive rights, at least with respect to baked goods, they shouldn't be allowed to sell baked goods. So we quoted from the Sugi and Baba Basra. Sugi and Baba Basra, paskins like Rapuna Breda Rav Yoshua, that you can't stop somebody from the same neighborhood in which you live, from or even from a different neighborhood in the same city, from opening up a competing store, because you can say that, hey, you're, you know, doing your part, you know, attracting your customers, and I'm doing my part attracting my customers, and that's perfectly acceptable. So Schwartz said we basically paskin that way, and therefore on that basis there is no right for the bakery owner to stop at this store from opening up and selling baked goods. And he quotes from an Aruch HaShulchan who points out that if there would have been if the neighborhood would be such where the streets did not go through, were not mefulash, did not go from one end to another end, and it was sort of like a private little area. So he does go from the Aruch HaShulchan that there's another claim that somebody can make if you opened up another store in that area, that it's going to cause like more traffic into the area. But he says that's not true if it's mefulash. Now the streets are mefulash. The Chicago, as we know, is a great grid. That's what I was told when I moved into Chicago, you know. So you can come in from south, you know, northeast and west from all directions. So therefore he rejects that argument. And then he says, however, he does, and this is what Sir Schwartz's approach to his Hasaga school cases, which is you don't really have a case, but there are some later Achronim who said that if you're going to really rip apart the person's livelihood entirely, that they're not going to be able to make ends meet according to the socioeconomic requirements of their community. And that's the Rav Moshe's standard. So then it would be appropriate to make some sort of an accommodation under those circumstances. So then he says, Lefizeh, last paragraph, Tzrichin Chaveri Moses Esses Rabbanim Adonim Sheila Na Das Prati Amatzav. So therefore, you need to know the specifics of exactly how much money the person's making, how much this is going to potentially diminish the livelihood of the first baker of the bakery that's already there. Yet Pisuk Yusei Mamish Kipishni Spar Leil. And if there's a determination by the mumkum, the experts, that you can possibly maintain both stores, as near so then there's no reason to stop the owner from the opening up the second person from opening up the grocery store. That was Schwartz's general approach. Sometimes we would say, oh, don't sell this item quite the same way. Open up different hours, though, and you'll let this one be more takeout than sit down. And said this one will not sell the big great specialty item that this other store sells, and so forth. But generally, he would always allow the second owner to open up. But he points out there was no actual din tov. This was just a question that was posed in my Rabbi Shandalov. So Schwartz is very careful. He said, I'm not paskening. He said, if in fact the two sides are going to want to have a full-fledged din Torah, so let the Bezdin decide, and if they decide differently than what I've written, ain't iro mitzidi. He says, I am not going to have any complaints. I'm not going to have any tainas, any grievances against any Bezdin that might decide otherwise. That's the prerogative of every single Bezdin. But Schwartz was very humble in that particular way. Okay. Yunamilkas Medina Simon Beis. Very beautiful. Just read the words of Rav Schwartz. He sat down and wrote a beautiful, elegant Hebrew. This whole tshuva about the way in which the state is set up in Medinat Yisrael. What is the source of their authority? He quotes various svarim that were written in order to delineate halakhic parameters for the modern day state of Israel by Rav Chaim Hirshenson, whom we like to quote, even though he said many people disagreed with many of the things that he wrote, which is true. The Hilchos Medina of Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg. And he points out, it's very interesting, that there were two different types of authority, at least with respect to articulating criminal law. One is through the Bezdin, and one is through the idea of having a Malchus. And he points out, just like we have a notion of Moed B'Malchus, that person rebels against the king of Israel, so that's a very strict punishable offense. So he quotes from Rav Kook that the same is true, as on page 119, that the same is true with respect to modern-day Israel, even though we don't have actual kings. Nonetheless, the fact that you have sort of a general agreement of society that you're going to create a government, so the need to have a respect for that government is the same as when you would have a Melech Yisrael. The two different categories that Schwartz talks about mimic a little bit those two categories that are discussed in the Drushas HaRan, famous Drushas HaRan, which is in Drusha Yud Aleph, in which the Ran points out that you need to have A Bezdin system, which is set up to decide according to Torah law, and that is the main system of law upon which Jewish society is based. And you also need to have mitzvah samelech for a king to be able to set up a criminal system, for example, so that you'll have law and order, because if you only have things decided according to the Bezdin, very often you let off criminals, because we have a principle of Yitzilo Eda, everything requires hasra, a warning, a person who's a matir asmo lemisa says, yeah, I know I'm going to get the death penalty, and that's why I'm doing it anyway. Probably won't happen so often, and therefore you need to have a mitzvah samelech, you need to have like a separate, you know, governmental criminal system as well. But he says that's why the melech has to always walk around with the sacred Torah at all times, because the melech has to understand that ultimately he is subservient to the law of the Torah. He just has some additional prerogatives, but the law of the Torah is the main law of the land. So Rav Schwartz, after this very, very elegant essay, came to the conclusion, and he just said that he is bothered a little bit by the fact that the main legal system of the state of Israel is based upon Turkish law and British law, and not upon Jewish law. And he says that's something that he feels really needs to be fixed. But he wishes, you know, for the absolute best for the future of the state of Israel, an appropriate, you know, sentiment as we go into Yom HaTzimut shortly. The Hashba Mishpat V'Shalom Emes of Ba'aretz. That we should have a proper, you know, judgment reside in the land in accordance with Torah principles. The last tshuva is about Minei Ra'yusha B'Yerov Rabbanus in Siman Gimel. Does the rabbinate, is it something which goes down in inheritance or not? Or is it something which you just give to the most capable person? And he quotes from the Maharaj Dam and the Asar Mamoros of the Rama Mipanu, who all say that when it comes to Torah, so Torah is not Yerusha, right? Torah does not go in inheritance. Torah is just let the best man win. Whoever is the most qualified to be the posek is the one who should be the posek, who should be appointed as the Rav, even though other positions of authority go be Yerusha, not the Rabbanus. And he quotes two conflicting shuvas of the Ksam Sofer. Ksam Sofer says in one, like this Maharaj Dam and Rama Mipanu, that it doesn't go be Yerusha. And another one he says, oh, but that's with respect to what rabbinical positions used to be. It was all about Torah and Kedusha. Nowadays, it's about being a social director. And nowadays, it's about being a social director and basically just like running programs and giving pastoral counseling and things like that. So then, that's not really about Torah. That's just about kind of, you know, being an administrator of an organization. And therefore, he says that nowadays, it really is Torah, and it would go to Yerusha, it would go to the children. Rav Schwartz, interestingly, does slant towards those postkim who held that it is something that should go be Yerusha, because Rav Schwartz held that you had to give a lot of respect to the rabbinate and to rabbinical positions. It was inconceivable to Rav Schwartz that you wouldn't treat the rabbinate with the same type of gravitas and respect that you would treat other types of authority. So therefore, Rav Schwartz felt that all else being equal, assuming that you do have, you know, worthy sons who would be able to take over their father's position, he felt that was something that should be taken seriously, lahalacha. And I think it's really also indicative of Rav Schwartz's general view of man malchi rabban, who is considered to be really the torchbearers of royalty nowadays. It's the rabbis within our community, and certainly malchus is something which goes to Yerusha, and we'll stop here, and we'll continue next week. And Yitzchak Shem with the Mishnah.
Thank you. Mostly here, they're not yet done. Right.